You're listening to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with an emphasis on homeopathy. In this episode, we're going to be talking about some things that might be a little hard for some people to hear because we're focusing on trauma. So there might be some traumatic events that are discussed that could be problematic for some people. So just listen carefully if this is one that you might have concerns about, whether it would impact you negatively, or if you really think that it might not be so great for you, go ahead and skip it until you're ready for it at another time. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to our third episode with Dr. Karen Lamb for Mom and Doc Talk here. I'm going to go ahead and read her bio this time, even though we skipped it last time. Hopefully you've already seen all of her or seen or watched or listened to the other two episodes where we discussed all the details about trauma and conceptualizing trauma and how it impacts pans and pandas families. And today we're going to dive into details about treatment. So for anybody who might have just skipped it because you're like, yep, I already understand trauma. I know I got it. Just tell me what to do about it. I want to make sure you know who we're talking to and why she's here. So this is Dr. Karen Lamb, a very dear friend of mine. She is a naturopathic medical doctor and a licensed professional counselor specializing in trauma healing, burnout recovery, and mind-body wellness. I mean, like all the stuff we need for pans, pandas, families, right? With a deep understanding of the highly sensitive person experience, she blends natural medicine with evidence-based psychological therapies to help her patients restore balance and vitality. Trained in EMDR, mindfulness, cognitive behavioral therapy, and dialectical behavioral therapy, Dr. Lamb is passionate about addressing the root causes of emotional and physical imbalances. Through her practice at Pura Vida Natural Medicine, she empowers individuals to heal, build resilience, and achieve lasting well-being. So Dr. Lamb, thank you so much for all of the time you've already given us. Like I said before, I highly recommend that even if you think you already know, like I got trauma, like you got to listen to Dr. Lamb talk about this. She talks about trauma in just such a beautiful way that is really validating, especially for Pans Pandas families and the just the extent of what happens in the family, as well as, you know, she understands homeopathy. She understands the highly sensitive person, and she understands all of these things in a way that you just aren't going to get elsewhere. So it's worth going and listening to those first two episodes, even if you think you already understand everything about trauma. I promise you, you'll be surprised and validated and empowered by at least one thing that she said. But let's go ahead and dive in. Let's talk about treatments today. So we got one question from our community that I thought was really a fantastic question. And that's, what do you wish all therapists knew about trauma?
Love this question. It's so many things. So I originally was a therapist. That was my first profession. And then I added naturopathic medicine. And so I love, my heart really is with the therapist world. It really is kind of where I feel I connect the best. But the naturopathic interventions were so exciting and interesting to me. And I think a lot of therapists are that way. So my first answer to that question is the critical role that nutrient deficiencies play in the recovery process. Mm-hmm. And that is particularly true for this population, but really anyone who is suspecting the possibility of trauma. So that's really important. Another thing that comes to mind for me is that trauma therapy is not regular therapy. Trauma-informed is not just about working with people with trauma. It's also about doing your own work. And I think a lot of therapists are open to this, but I have met some that haven't done their own work. And I don't think anybody who is a therapist should not, anyone who is a therapist should do their own work. That is across the board. I try to be really flexible about the things that I say. This is something that I can't think of an exception for this, because you're working with people from all walks of life and you just never know when your stuff is going to come up. And not only that, it helps, you know, in supporting them as well. So aside from that, doing our own trauma work helps us to be able to connect more deeply, and it helps us to have more compassion. And so anyone who's doing trauma work, absolutely without question, should go through that themselves. Another thing is trauma stored in the body, not just the mind. We've talked a lot about that here. That's something that is without question. You know, I think there was a time in my training where I was like, that makes sense to me, but is it really? Oh my gosh, yes. There's no question. And now there's some research that's showing, you know, that it manifests in autoimmune conditions and fatigue and digestive issues and chronic pain. And even some commercials that are saying that depression hurts, you know, mm-hmm. physically hurts. So there's a lot more validation about that now. But that is not something that conventional medicine tends to default to. So understanding that as a therapist is really powerful, and can be, psychoeducation can be one of the interventions that can be really helpful mm-hmm. in those instances. With highly sensitive people, especially, I think it's important for therapists to understand that gentle and titrated interventions can be just as, if not more effective for this population, because going too aggressive into a protocol can actually cause re-traumatization. So when people say, I don't want to rehash something, I don't want to go back there, there's a lot of wisdom in that. And you don't have to, right? So like homeopathy is a great example of that. But a lot of other types of therapies that we'll talk about offer that possibility. Yeah, I could talk about this for a very long yeah. time. But yeah, not needing to relive the trauma is very, very important, because early on in trauma training, there's just very specific protocols. And when you're first starting to do trauma work, you want to be really by the book. And mm-hmm. and I think just the awareness that it's not always necessary, and you can collaborate with your client mm-hmm. to develop a track that honors the structure of whatever, you know, therapeutic intervention you're using, and also their specific needs, is possible even in the early stages of being a trauma therapist.
So as you mentioned, trauma-informed therapy isn't the same as trauma therapy, and there are specific strategies to treat trauma. So what therapies are used to actually address trauma?
Well, I've done a lot of different types of training in trauma trainings, trauma therapy trainings. And the ones that I keep coming back to, and the ones that I have really invested a lot of time in for myself personally and in my work, it has been EMDR. Of course, we've touched on that. I have seen magical transformations with EMDR. Internal family systems more recently has been a more recent addition in the last 10 years or so. And that has been revolutionary. I really like the combination of the two. It allows for more attachment work, whereas EMDR, and we can get into the specifics of what that is doesn't focus as much on that. And, you know, when we're talking about things like gestational or birth trauma, and lots of other forms of trauma, but specifically that one, we see a lot of attachment disorders arise from really, really early traumas in childhood, because of the effects that it has on the nervous system, but also the hypervigilant state that keeps people from being able to feel safe enough to trust even their caregivers. So those are two of my favorites. Somatic experiencing is also a favorite, because of the integration of the body and body awareness, which I think is really powerful. And they all are founded in mindfulness, which is, I think, a really powerful leverage that we have in therapy. So all of these affect the epigenetic markers and the nervous system, and homeopathy, obviously. Let's put that one in there since we can't stop talking about it.
Right.
Those are my go-tos, and I'm happy to expand on any of them.
Yeah, I would actually, I want to just dive into those a little bit so that people have an understanding of what they are. So let's start with EMDR. So yes. First, tell us what EMDR stands for and what people would expect if they were going to see an EMDR therapist, and a little bit about how it works.
Yes. So EMDR stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It originally involved eye movement, but it now we understand that it is just a matter of bilateral stimulation. So that can be eyes moving from side to side, sounds going from one ear to the other. It can be tactile, where you're holding something or somebody is tapping you from side to side. And what that's doing is it's engaging the each hemisphere of the brain one at a time. So it'll stimulate one hemisphere and then the other as you are thinking about a target. And that target can be a big T target, it can be a little T target, or it can be the fly that's you can't stop, you know, whacking at, and it's making you really frustrated and aggravated, because that may be a symptom picture that stems from the original trauma, difficulty regulating emotions. So what happens is, as you're thinking about the trauma, the bilateral stimulation is volleying, moving the information from one hemisphere to the other. And this is how the brain digests information. When we have enough resources, our brain does that naturally without needing to stimulate it. However, when we're in a state of crisis, we're overloaded. And there is not, it's like trying to eat a whole cabbage at once, right? Your body just can't do that. And so the cabbage just stays whole in your mm-hmm. stomach, if you can, mm-hmm. if you can even get that far. And then it stays in this short-term memory, right? Mm-hmm. So the trauma stays in short-term memory, which is why we would see flashbacks and these subtle distortions that we talked about in episode one. Mm-hmm. Or the first one, 91, yeah. I guess it is. One for me. And what that means is it's just a constant draining of energy and nutrients, because you're having to regurgitate the same information over and over and over, because the body is not in a place to process it. Mm-hmm. So that's where EMDR comes in. We do this bilateral stimulation. The information goes from left to right, left to right, left to right, while you're thinking about any particular, the targets that you've identified with your therapist. And what's happening is that memory is getting digested. It's getting broken down into smaller and smaller pieces. And eventually it's repackaged into this really tiny, you know, memory that can be moved over to the long-term storage department of the brain. So that is eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing. Tons of research. One of my favorite ones is first responders that were classified into a control group that had no treatment, a group that had just talk therapy, and then a group that had EMDR. And they all experienced the same trauma. So the first responders were all at the same exact trauma. And they did functional MRIs on each of the groups, and it showed their brain in real life, real time, with a high amount of blood flow to the amygdala, which is associated with fight or flight, sympathetic overdrive after the trauma. So all three groups had the exact same starting point. And then they did the interventions for all three groups. Well, one didn't get any intervention, so that post-test was exactly the same as would be expected. The talk therapy group had some slight decrease in blood flow to the amygdala and a little bit of increase to the prefrontal cortex, but it was the EMDR group that had completely resolved the trauma, and there was no hyper circulation to the amygdala. And it was all, when thinking about the target, had normalized, and blood flow was totally not PTSD. Mm-hmm. And that's my favorite. It's one of my favorite studies. That was like 2000. So it's been around for some time, and it's incredibly effective.
Yeah.
I could talk about it for a long time. So I'll stop.
I love EMDR. We're going to talk about it more, because I know that it's one of your favorites. It's one of my favorites, and it's super effective. I do want to talk about a couple of the other, like the, you mentioned the internal family systems and somatic experiencing, just so people mm-hmm. know what they are at the very least. I know that's not your favorite, so it's probably not what we're going to spend most of the time talking about, but at least want to touch on it since you mentioned it. Before yeah. we do that though, I think I might've told you one-on-one before, but I'll share it now with everybody. So my first career, I was an Arabic translator in defense intelligence. And we actually had somebody come in when I was after I was out of the military, but I was a defense contractor. Somebody came in to teach us, basically to teach us EMDR, and like had us practicing on each other and like tapping each other's shoulders, and was like trying to teach us how we could do it like on our own with like tapping our legs. And it was not explained well enough. So we all left going, what the heck was that? We didn't know what we were getting when we were walking into it. And it's so sad to me because the work that we did had traumatic experiences associated with it and like things that we needed to process. And so I'm so grateful that we had this tool that was like, and this is in part to say just how grounded in evidence this particular therapy is, that it was brought in to talk to defense contractors about. I just wish that it had been presented by maybe you or somebody who could have talked to us a little bit about what they were doing and why we were doing it. And it just felt so like out there woo woo at first. I was like, well, I'm going to tap away a bad memory. Like, what the heck are you talking about? So anyway, there's a lot of basis to it, to first responders, military, all that. So, but let's touch quickly on internal family systems. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is
and how this one's a little bit more difficult to describe? But it's just wonderful. I love it because it addresses the attachment piece. That EMDR definitely can, especially if you have a really strong therapeutic relationship with your therapist. But on its own, the protocol as it is taught does not focus on attachment. It really focuses on the digestion or the processing of the trauma. So internal family systems is based on the understanding that we all people have different parts of our psyche, and such as, you know, the wounded child or the scapegoat or the protector or critic or perfectionist, or, you know, these parts we're born with, and when we experience trauma, they become burdened, and those parts can become the symptom picture, basically. So again, it's really difficult to describe it in a short period of time. Yeah. I have all my little analogies. The reason that I like internal family systems is because, one, as it talk therapy goes, it is lightning speed compared to conventional talk therapy. And two, it addresses the attachment piece with ourselves. So oftentimes we think of attachment disorders as being problematic in interpersonal relationships, but it stems from the fact that we have broken relationships between these parts within ourselves. And over time, we learned through internal family systems, which frankly, cognitive behavioral therapy, somatic experiencing, you know, all of these other types of therapies that I've worked in, haven't ever really touched self-compassion in the way that internal family systems does. And it happens in just a really beautiful way. And it can have a spiritual component, not religious, but a spiritual component that for some people is really appealing and is an important aspect of who they are. And so it naturally can work really well with people who have that background.
I've heard a little bit about internal family systems and done a little bit of reading on it. And you're the first person who I've heard conceptualize it from the place of self-compassion. And I love it. And it makes me feel like I need to potentially revisit it a little bit more for myself, because like the main person that's always talked about for like self-compassion is Kristen Neff, right? Mindfulness for self-compassion. And I'm just like, okay, how do you actually just go from mindfulness to feeling okay about yourself and having compassion for yourself, but like understanding that these different things that you're feeling or things that feel like conflicting internally have a role, and then you can have a compassion for that particular role, like you would have compassion for somebody external from you. I think that's a good conceptualization. So I'm with you.
I really struggled with self-compassion for a really, really long time. And this broke through in a way that nothing else ever had. And so for me personally, I see it over and over and over and over in sessions. So it's fantastic. I can't speak, enough great things about it.
So the last one that you mentioned was somatic experiencing. Can you tell us what that is?
Yes. So this one focuses a lot on the nervous system. And that's not to say that IFS and EMDR don't. Obviously, that's the goal of all trauma work, is to tap into the nervous system. Somatic experiencing, really, that's the intervention, is tapping into the nervous system, and shifting it out of fight or flight. But it focuses on moving into the body. And at first it's done by the therapist, and eventually by the client. But that can be really overwhelming for people to think about, because when there's trauma, the first thing that we do is we move out of the body. One of the symptoms of PTSD or CPTSD is dissociation. Mm-hmm. And even as young children, we see that happening, and, you know, where they, it can be as simple as being a really cognitive person, you know, where you just are very analytical, and, you know, you like to take things apart and put them back together in your mind. That is oftentimes an avoidance of being in the body. So somatic experience can both be very helpful for that, but it can also be, people can have an aversion to it because they feel that it is dangerous to be in the body, because that is where traumas occurred. Or for sensitive people, it's where we feel so intensely and we get so much information that we learn to retreat in our minds. So even though we may feel some hesitancy to go towards something like somatic experiencing or body awareness, it can be incredibly beneficial.
My last comment before I let Jody dive in here with some questions that I'm sure she's dying to ask. I've gone through trauma therapy a couple of different times. I've gone through something called cognitive processing therapy that was developed and done through the VA. And that's the type of therapy that people generally want to avoid, right? Where like you had to like write down the story of the traumatic experience or like, you know, or record an audio, and then you had to read it and listen to it and do it again and again and again, like until you were just desensitized to it. And that's one thing that I love about EMDR, and I haven't done the other two as in depth, but I've played around with them a little bit, is that it's really just trying to like restore balance in the body and like help things actually be processed, rather than just like, here's a way to make this not hurt so bad but it's still there. Right. And I love these two, because these have ways that I'm sure we'll talk about here shortly that you can navigate through these therapies without like living in the trauma and sometimes not even talking about it. Right. Which can be so vital to help people recover if they're just not in the place that they can go there. So that's all.
Yes, I did not mention exposure therapy, which is mm-hmm. considered to be a form of trauma therapy, because I dislike it deeply.
Immensely.
Yes, immensely. I am not, even narrative therapy, I don't think is appropriate for trauma. It's too re-traumatizing sometimes. So I'm a huge fan of the interventions that don't require you to have to rehash everything.
Well, and it's just, to me now, I'm just wondering, for the first time ever in this conversation, am I so good at suppressing because I went through CPT and I basically had to learn how to not have the feelings I was having to something. And then I just broadened it to everything else and look what impacts it had. So is there a possibility that it led to deeper, different suffering?
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So I want to make a comment on something that you guys were talking a little bit about, or maybe just thank you, because I have felt for a good long while, at least a year now, that something was a little broken with me, because I call myself an EMDR dropout, because I did one session, one of the actual sessions. I did a couple leading up to it, and I had a response that did not feel good to me. And it was too much. But from what I'm hearing you say, is there are many other options, or there are other options, and maybe we just went too hard with me. And that's where we talked about in the last episode, finding the right provider. Because I think as moms, we don't know. Like, I know that there's these therapies available, but I don't know what I need. And I tried one thing and it didn't work out. And I have just opted not to try anything else, because I didn't. Well, now I understand what the other options are. but it wasn't the right thing for me at the time. It wasn't that I failed at something.
Yeah. No, no. The psychologist that developed dialectical behavioral therapy was so adamant about it's not ever the client that fails, ever. It is the therapy. The therapy fails the client. And so it's not even about the therapist. I mean, although hopefully I'll add this to my list. And I think I kind of touched on it. You know, if it's not working, pivot, you know, because it can be so damaging for people to think that, oh, well, there's something wrong with me because this is such an effective therapy for so many people. Mm-hmm. And it might not even be pivoting to a different modality. It might just be readjusting the way that you approach it. Going too fast, too hard, too quickly is very commonly a way that EMDR and other trauma therapies fail. Wow. So that very well could be the case for you, or it could be that it's not the right modality for you. I've had two people that I've worked with EMDR that it absolutely was not the right. It wouldn't matter if we slowed down, if we shifted targets, you know, it just wasn't the right modality for them. So that's possible. More often than not, it's the speed and the chosen targets. And so if there's one thing that I can stress for everybody listening, it's the vital, critical importance of connecting well with your therapist. Mm-hmm. If you have one or two appointments, which I hope you would have at least one or two appointments before any trauma intervention is attempted, or more than one or two, but at least one or two, and you're just like, it's okay. You need somebody else.
Yeah.
You need to feel like, and this might sound kind of dramatic, but you need to feel like there's a possibility that that person could be your best friend. Yeah. Like, not that you would be, right? Because that would not be ethical, but just that you feel a connection with that person. You feel seen by them. You feel understood by them. You feel respected by them. And it could unfold into a really, really wonderful, supportive relationship. If the ingredients for that are not there, cut your losses and find a new therapist, because the relationship is the most fundamentally important therapeutic intervention.
Yeah. I feel like this is another super, super random thing, but as you were explaining EMDR and you were explaining how the memories move around in the body, like, I just want to hear like your thoughts. I'm thinking of the movie. What's the movie with Riley and the emotions and
Inside Out.
Have you seen the movies and do you just love them? Because it, like, as you're explaining that to me, I'm like visualizing what's happening in that movie. And suddenly I can like understand what you're talking about because I've seen the movie and I can see the things moving around.
Yes. Yes. And the second one was IFS to a T, like internal family systems, like all of those little parts in Riley's brain were parts that we all experience like that. So I love that series. It's so good.
I remembered that we needed to talk about complex PTSD, mm-hmm. and you said there's different therapies for it. So I'm guessing that EMDR, IFS, and somatic experiencing may be less effective with complex PTSD.
So it's the way the therapy is done. So for example, I have worked with PTSD, people who have been diagnosed with non-complex PTSD and had two sessions and completely cleared out the targets. Mm-hmm. Complex PTSD will never, by definition, be a simple process, right? Like it is something that requires a tremendous amount of length of time with EMDR, and a combination is really, really helpful in those cases. The complex piece requires the attachment. PTSD can exist in the absence of attachment disorder or attachment trauma. Complex PTSD always has an attachment piece. So mm-hmm. the combination of IFS and EMDR is what I use for complex mm-hmm. PTSD because of the attachment piece.
That makes sense. Yeah. Thanks for making sure we got that part answered. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you can do to help with trauma while it's actively still happening? Like, let's say a PANS family has got a kiddo that's violent, both for the parent and the kind of family and the child.
I think we've touched on the importance of safety for true healing, right? Like true trauma healing, and needing the crisis to be mostly resolved when you're going to be addressing the trauma. However, there is the resourcing. And, you know, that comes back to having a therapeutic relationship with someone, not going into the trauma work per se, but just having a therapeutic relationship that feels supportive and you've got an objective party and all of that. The nutritional and physical support is really important. You know, so one of the first things I said that I wish all therapists knew is how impactful our physiological state is to our ability to heal and not predispose us to further trauma. So having somebody who can support your just small micro habits, you know, that can help to improve your feeling more resourced, supporting sleep, supporting diet, supporting scheduling. And all of these things sound really simple, but they're the first things to go, first of all. And second of all, it's really difficult to be thinking about that when you are actively managing really complex situations at home. And this is actually what inspired me to develop the Thriving Sensitivity Program for sensitive people. And it's these foundational aspects of resilience, so that you set up a plan for yourself so that everything is written out and you know exactly what your keystone habit is, that if that's out of place, everything else falls apart. So the supportive aspect, you know, the resourcing yourself nutritionally and energetically and all of that might feel really overwhelming, which is why I advocate for having a third, you know, an objective person in your life to support you, whether that's a naturopathic doctor or a therapist or a life coach. Careful with that, because they're not trauma informed. And so if there's a lot of that, but sometimes, you know, there's a time and a place for different types of providers.
What about healing it? Can you actually heal trauma while it's still happening?
I think that there can be micro healing. If you have support, the big healing, the big H healing, requires safety, and it requires predictable and stable environments. And so if there is trauma actively happening, then the goal really is to reduce harm as much as possible. And sometimes when we implement certain routines or structures into our lives with the help of, you know, professional support, we can see small healing happening during a crisis. It's complex and difficult, but it is possible. I've seen it happen. The definition of crisis management in dialectical and behavioral therapy is to focus on not making a crisis worse. Mm-hmm. And so that to me is the priority when somebody is still in a crisis situation, is not adding more crisis. So basically stopping the hemorrhage of energy and protecting us from being more susceptible to more trauma. Again, that compounding of trauma. So that's the first step. And that's what I would have people focus on first and foremost, is try to reduce harm, basically. And then from there are ways of supporting your nervous system and tending to attachment relationships, you know, with the sibling, with the partner, et cetera, and connecting in a way that actually helps to strengthen the relationship. And that kind of support can be very healing in those circumstances.
I just have to say, it comes to mind, and I'm sure that Jody is thinking this, and Dr. Lamb, you're probably thinking this too, or like maybe it'll make a light bulb go off if you're not already thinking it. But so I think about mold, and that mold is such a common thing that comes up with our community, and affects so many people. And so homeopathy can help with starting to heal, sort of like you were saying, micro healing. It can start to heal the susceptibility to the reactions that we have to mold. It can start to heal the susceptibility we have to trauma. But yes. At some point, we're going to be like bailing out a boat while it's still actively raining, right? Yes. And so we can make progress. We can, but to a point. And then at some point, we do have to address the situation to be able to get to full recovery. Yes. But addressing the thing that is just pouring in so that the body can both heal from the thing and have like a bit of a break from it too, so that it can do that deeper level of healing.
Very relevant analogy and very, very appropriate. So you've got, you know, a water damage that is, you still have the leak, mm-hmm. right? So you still have active water contamination in the home and the mold is spreading and spreading and spreading. The crisis management there is you first stop the water source, then dry, and you have to remove the mold, right? Ultimately, that's what you're referring yep. to, is that homeopathy can only take you so far, or trauma work can only take you so far until the environment is safe.
Yep.
Yeah.
What about, of all of the therapies that you've talked about, can any of those be done in nonverbal, someone who's nonverbal?
Yes. EMDR, actually, it has been researched in nonverbal clients. Therapists adapt the therapy approach. And so they'll use a lot of images, focus on body sensations, which EMDR naturally does, or at least the way that I do it. That's the somatic piece that I incorporate, but oftentimes it is incorporated into EMDR traditionally. So there can be, EMDR can be done with art, it can be done with movement, it can be done with gestures. And frankly, I've done it where there is no speech whatsoever. The person was not nonverbal, but they could not talk about the trauma. And mm-hmm. so we didn't. And we just had signs, you know, where the person would tell me if something was moving. You know, we basically did some education around what were the things that we were looking for, and it worked. So yes, it absolutely can be done with nonverbal.
I've heard that it can even be done in infants. Is that accurate?
I have heard that too. I don't personally have any experience with that. But that's, I mean, it's tapping.
I mean, I guess like infants would kind of just be living in it.
Yes.
Know, whatever it is that they're, so it just, all you're doing is like giving them the stimulation to help it actually, whatever they're living in, to move. So, because they have not yet learned to suppress.
Yes. And the bilateral stimulation, even without doing EMDR, consistently helps to downregulate the nervous system. So even if you're not thinking about a target or addressing it in a session, it does help to reduce stress and tension. Mm-hmm. So with an infant as well, I imagine.
So I've said a lot of times that homeopathy and EMDR and other trauma therapies can just work really well together, and they sort of like are synergistic. And so I just love to hear your thoughts on that.
I mean, it's a love story, as you can as you can relate. They complement each other so beautifully. They're both working on every aspect, you know, so comprehensive, physiological, psychological, energetic. And, you know, the way that I see it specifically help, because I got to rein myself in here, the way I see homeopathy specifically help with EMDR is that it improves bandwidth. Mm-hmm. It opens resources. And so when trauma work is heavy, you know, even in the fastest, I want to say simplest, but trauma work is never simple, but even in the least complex presentations, it's a lot, and people can find it to be taxing, or fear that it will be taxing. And then of course the fear that it will be taxing can be taxing in and of itself and create anxiety. So if homeopathy helps to improve bandwidth, then we can go deeper into the healing. And of course that's more effective, and we can go faster and mm-hmm. get it done, you know, with less time. So there's the recovery time can be shorter because sometimes, you know, EMDR will take 24 to 48 hours to finish processing. So once the session is done, trauma healing continues, trauma reprocessing continues for that time. And during that time, there can be dreams, there can sometimes disrupted sleep, things like that. Homeopathy is fantastic with all of those things. And if you're on the right remedy, will likely prevent you from consciously knowing that that's happening, which is great. Mm-hmm. Your body's doing the job and you don't even have to spend any energy on it.
Yeah. I found that like homeopathy, so it helps with the inflammatory component. So mm-hmm. I always say you can't out therapy inflammation, right? So it right. helps with any inflammatory or physiological factors that are contributing to it. It can also help with some of the symptoms that you're experiencing associated with it, just so that you can not feel as escalated with things, which is probably where you're talking about the bandwidth, right? So like it can help with the symptoms that you have associated with the trauma that to give you just some relief so that then you can actually process the thoughts associated with it too.
Yes.
I think for me personally, I know I said I did EMDR like a year ago. I'm pretty sure it was longer, like maybe two and a half years ago. I think for me, one of the reasons why it failed was because I was terrified to feel anything because I was one of those people that like stuffed it all away and I didn't feel anything. I was just frozen the whole time. No emotions, nothing. What homeopathy has allowed me to do is very slowly feel some things. And I probably have less fear of really feeling a thing with EMDR. Does that make sense? So just
absolutely
a gentler way of going about it. Maybe.
Yeah. I would recommend that people do homeopathy before any trauma work. Absolutely. When I'm working with people, that's my goal. I mean, there are times when it just doesn't align for people, you know, and that happens every now and then, but I think it's a wonderful way to resource and resourcing is a requirement before you do any trauma work, especially, I mean, specifically it's a part of the MDR protocol. And I think homeopathy is a way of resourcing without a doubt.
Yeah.
How does somebody go about finding a qualified trauma therapist?
There is a website that will list all of the certified EMDR therapists. It's EMDR International Association, so EMDRIA. And they are pretty much kind of the accrediting organization. So they have a search directory that you can search and you'll find all of the certified therapists there. Remember, the fit is most important. It doesn't matter if somebody has really fantastic reviews online, they may not be the right fit for you. And that's okay. I really want to normalize this because we feel a sense of investment once we've had that first appointment, you know, and if somebody offers a get to know you appointment, even if it's just 5 minutes talking to them on the phone, that right then and there, you might feel a vibe that's just not quite the right, you know, fit, or it's not quite aligned with you, and go with that. That's critical. The relationship is the number one tool. It is the foundation of any type of intervention that anybody uses. So it's very important.
Yeah. And what about doing it? Do you have to be in person to do EMDR or somatic experience? And I asked this because I feel like, Dr. Barr, what did I used to tell you? I used to tell you like the PANS community needed a Dr. Barr in their pocket, a doctor to talk. And I feel like it's the same thing with you, Dr. Lamb, is you are like just, I could imagine what my experience of PANS and after PANS would have been like, had I had somebody like you that understood it, that understood highly sensitive person, like I could see how it is very easy to feel like we could be besties. And now I understand why y'all are such good friends too. So can this be done remotely?
Yes. And that's actually something that's grown quite a bit since the pandemic, of course. Mm-hmm. But I moved from Arizona to Colorado almost 9 years ago. And so pre-pandemic, I was like, before it became you know, a big thing, the virtual work. So I was already doing EMDR at that point, virtually. And then of course, during the pandemic, a lot of people started doing it. So it's very, very possible to do. Some people do a lot better in person. You know, it's just, especially if there's a lot of dissociation, sometimes that can be difficult to do remotely, although I have done that. But it requires, I think, a very seasoned therapist to be able to ground somebody who is not physically in front of you. But there are some people that just, they need in person, and you should know that, you know, about yourself. Or if you don't know that and you start a virtual relationship like this, I think it's important to pivot as soon as you realize that it's not grounding enough for you, because trauma work does require a very grounding experience. But yes, it can be done remotely.
I'm just going to jump in to share a little bit about my experience. So I've only ever done EMDR virtually. So I've done a couple of like just one-off sessions with you, like from different states. And then even here in California, I've had EMDR with a therapist that was only done virtually. So just a few quick tips about this for anybody who's looking at doing it virtually. I did learn that certain headsets don't actually do the audio on the alternating signs. And so you need to make sure that you actually have equipment that will work to do what you need to do. The second thing I realized is that, so I had the therapist that I did like a more prolonged thing with probably was not the right fit, and probably should have known when I had to tell her like, it was not working for me, because she wanted to do both audio and a visual, like with a thing bouncing across. And I had to tell her, I was like, I can't do all of this. This is too much. If I'm watching the thing, I'm not thinking through, like I'm not following my memory web. So I'm not actually processing anything because I'm focusing on the ball moving. And so I think just being able to clearly communicate those types of things and finding the specific tool that will help you to do the work is probably important, especially if you're doing things virtually where you're not having somebody who has the tools with them in the office. So my question for you is, are there any risks with EMDR or with, you know, the other therapies that you mentioned? So internal family systems or somatic experience, are there any risks that people need to be aware of?
EMDR and IFS are very, very safe, generally speaking. When I feel like I'm, you know, just saying the same thing over and over and over, when you have a good relationship with your therapist, it's so critical, because if something doesn't feel right, you need to feel safe enough to be able to communicate that to them. And they should be receptive and flexible in how they adjust or propose an adjustment. So the therapy itself, the riskiest thing about a therapy, any trauma therapy, is somebody being more committed to the protocol than they are to the feedback that they're getting from, you know, the person that's going through the therapy. Whenever there is clear, easy dialogue between the therapist and the person going through the therapy, it's pretty sweet. I mean, it's hard to think of a risk. The risks really come up when the therapist is pushing boundaries to try to follow a specific protocol. They're going too quickly. A lot of the things that we've already talked about. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you feel that you are able to speak openly and feel safe with your therapist, generally speaking, the therapies are very safe. If it doesn't feel right, don't do that one. There's lots to choose from.
And how long does someone typically have to do EMDR or the other trauma therapies?
So much like with homeopathy, you know, I've seen people have total 180 degree turnarounds from one remedy, one potency, right? Not to say that they couldn't benefit from more, but like the symptom that they came in for was totally cleared in that one dose. And there are plenty of times with homeopathy where it's just next remedy, next remedy, next remedy, especially the more complicated the picture is. So that's pretty much the same with all trauma therapy. You know, with EMDR, it can be as fast and powerful as homeopathy can be in some cases, where I've done it with supporting loved ones in my community where they had a trauma and one or two sessions, and it just completely changed the perspective. And then, of course, I've worked with people for years with PTSD, where that's, you know, it's more complicated.
And does the EMDR or the other therapies that you mentioned actually heal the trauma?
So, yes, I really do think that it does heal the trauma, because trauma is a state of stuckness. And so kind of like what we were talking about with the functional MRIs, with the first responders, if you have something that is stuck in that short-term memory loop and you're re-experiencing it over and over and over, that is the definition of trauma. That is keeping your nervous system in this hypervigilant or fight or flight state. So once that is digested and packaged down into a small, manageable memory and then stored away, it's no longer, you know, activating you. And that means that you're no longer in a trauma state. You don't forget the memory. I think that's really important. I get that question a lot. The memory is not lost. The memory has a very different effect on your body. And it might still have sadness associated with it. That's natural, but it does not paralyze us. It does not take over. It doesn't drive the bus anymore.
So I have a thought here. I just want to throw it out there and see if we're vibing on this. So I feel like EMDR helps heal a specific trauma and the reaction and memory web that is with a specific trauma. And IFS helps to give you ways to cope with attachment issues that you're having related to trauma, and like the ways that you actually like relate to yourself, as you said, and self-compassion for some of the ways that maybe you're not responding how you want to. Somatic experiencing helps get you back in your body with the trauma, help calm the nervous system, and homeopathy helps address the susceptibility to things being traumatized in the first place or traumatizing
love
in the
it.
First place. Is that,
yeah,
that's sort of like how the interplay is. And I'm just going to say, this is why it's to me, like everything has to be individualized, right? Like, yes, there's protocols to follow.
Yes.
And we need to like meet the individual where they're at to figure out what combination of these things works really well together, which is why it's so beneficial not to just look for somebody who's EMDR qualified or somatic experiencing qualified, but to talk to the person if you can to find out, do you incorporate anything else? Because as you've said, you are an EMDR therapist, but you bring in aspects from these things depending on the needs of the individual. Just like we have to do with homeopathy, we have to meet the individual where they're at for what's going to work for them so that they can actually truly and fully heal and then have the skills that they need to be able to manage challenging things when they come up, hopefully not getting into a place of stuck trauma, but having the skills to navigate it so that it's a lower impact on them.
We're vibing for sure.
Awesome.
Surprise, you did surprise. That. You did that thing where you read our mom minds all the time, because I didn't know that I needed a breakdown, but now I even understand like the differences and all of that even better. So thank you, as always. Dr. Lam, what other therapies are supportive in healing trauma other than what we've talked about?
So those are my favorite. And I would definitely start with those. But that, you know, there's things that you can do outside of conventional therapy, like Qigong or Tai Chi, or and that incorporates bilateral movement. So there's some overlap there. I mentioned cranial sacral therapy earlier. There are some therapists that are incredibly gifted at this. And I think that it's definitely worth exploring, especially if there's that nervous system, you know, hyper arousal and the maybe hesitancy or resistance around the talk aspect of it. It's a really great way to start, or someone who's pre-verbal or nonverbal. Psychedelics, of course, are picking up in popularity and are legal in some states. I have seen wonderful things happen with psychedelics and healing trauma. there's a lot to be said there. So I'm gonna, I know we're,
we need an entire episode just
on that. Pretty much. So we're just psychedelics. Yeah. there's art therapy, that, you know, I don't know that it's necessarily going to do the super deep trauma work, but these might be intermediate steps that can help to loosen things up enough to feel like you can, like how we were describing homeopathy earlier, you know, getting you to a place where you feel like it's accessible. Yoga, there's trauma-informed yoga. There's a lot of research that is coming out around cold exposure therapy and retraining the nervous system to be able to tolerate, you know, have a more resilience for doing difficult things. That is not something that works for me at all. So as I'm going through these, you need to understand what is effective for you and trust that that is the case. You can have an open mind and try it if it feels, you know, that it's within that realm. But I just know that that's not for me. And I have so many colleagues that are all about it. And I read the research and I understand it. But that won't ever be something you will find me doing. It's not right for me. But there are so many other things that are.
Yeah. For some reason, I feel like I just need to acknowledge that one of the things that to me keeps coming up central, or that maybe is the underlying unsaid thing about trauma therapy, is the ability to trust yourself and therefore to trust things around you and to trust people around you and circumstances around you. And I bring this up because I feel like it's somebody out there needs to hear that if you're trying one of the things that Dr. Lam has said and it's not working for you, it's not like, trust yourself that it's not working for you. It's not because you're broken. It's not because you're irreparable. It's not because of any of the things that you're probably saying to yourself, because you haven't had a lot of internal family systems work and you don't know how to give yourself compassion for the hypercritical person that's telling you those things, right? That you're just somebody who that doesn't work for, and it's okay to trust yourself.
Yes. And there's something else. There are so many modalities. You mentioning that for some reason made me think that I had to mention equine therapy. I've seen that be the case where animal driven, you know, animal forward types of therapy help to shift things that other types of therapies didn't. So I know that was random addition, but trust yourself. And there are so many other trauma focused therapies that you'll find the thing that works.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Lam, I can't thank you enough for your generosity and all of the thoughts that you've shared with us. Is there anything we should have asked you about trauma that we didn't? We were pretty exhaustive, but...
Yeah. I mean, there are definitely things we could talk longer about, but I think, yeah. I mean, we did a nice job, I think, of covering. And if people have, you know, follow-up questions that come up for you guys, feel free to shoot them over to me and I can reach out to them.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I know that people are going to be dying to connect with you. So please tell us how people can find you, get in touch with you, all that. And we'll make sure we put everything you say in the show notes too.
Yes. ThrivingSensitivity.com is the program that I referenced a couple of times. And it also talks about my clinic and my services and my work. On Instagram, dr.karen.lam. And there's also if you think you might be a highly sensitive person, there's a Facebook group called Natural Health for the Highly Sensitive Person that has special resources and a bit of community. So that's a good resource if that is relevant for them.
For anybody who's a member of our Facebook group, I'm not part of this group, but I did talk to Dr. Lam about our group. And so I think it's very similar, where there's a lot of similar support and things like that in the Facebook group. So if you got something to compare it to, or something to have a general expectation. Dr. Lam, I'm so grateful. I'm grateful that you gave us your time and your expertise, that you gave us so many hours to chat through all of this, to share with the community. And I'm grateful to you as a friend. Almost every day, probably actually every day, something comes up that I am just grateful to have you in my life. And I know that I am speaking for a whole lot of people, and Jody probably wants to speak for a whole lot of people too, that whether they ever connect with you or not, I know that you have just made a whole lot of people feel seen and heard, and that their life is at least a little bit better because of what you have shared with us in the last three episodes. So thank you so much.
Thank you. That means so much to me. And likewise, I am so grateful for you and the work that you do. That's, in my opinion, the key right now is being the light.
And such a blessing to Pan's families, because I feel like you're the same thing. Resilience to me was breaking through walls of where support was lacking and the conversation was lacking. And the fact that you're willing to spend so much time with us and have these conversations, which I haven't heard anywhere else in the PANS community, it's just such a blessing, because these are things that are, they're brewing in us, and we don't even know that we need to talk about it. And we don't even acknowledge a lot of times that these are things that we need to pay attention to for our own health. So I really appreciate the conversation, the information, and you just coming and hanging out with us for longer. And I hope we get to hang out with you again in the future.
I imagine that probably this was too fun to not do again.
All right. Well, hopefully this was as enlightening and inspiring and empowering for you as it has felt for me, as it has felt for Jody. So thank you all for your time and attention to this really, really important topic that we just need to talk about more in the PANS Pandas community. So we will continue the conversation on all the things that we think are vital to talk about in the PANS Pandas community on our next episode. So we'll see you guys there. Take care, everybody.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We try to get a new episode out every week. You can make sure you don't miss any by following us on Spotify or subscribing to our channel on YouTube. If you want to connect with us more, join our Facebook group, Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas, where we have exclusive weekly videos and answer your questions about, you guessed it, homeopathy for Pans and Pandas throughout the week. If you are already a member, give us a shout out and let us know what you thought about this episode. If you aren't on Facebook and would like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com. Until next time, take care and remember, this won't be forever.